Hi, everyone. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about really sort of the on-the-ground part of this implementation, more the operational issues of, you know, you've heard a lot about the research methodology and implementation, but this is really a walk through each of the cities, and I'll try and articulate some of the themes that came up in trying to implement a consistent program across five very diverse places. Because, as you know, the program itself is quite simple. You know, there's a team, ACT or ICM, and there's apartments, and it would seem, you know, not that complicated. But each of the five cities had a very unique context that presented, in many ways, interesting challenges to what we initially thought would be a pretty straightforward approach. Let me describe the cities to you, maybe that would be, but I have to kind of skip around. This PowerPoint doesn't actually go in the sequence I wanted to. Oh, here we go. We could start this way. But I think of them in the reverse order, so I'll start this way and go back. So in Moncton, finding apartments and finding a team. Moncton was one of the easier places to implement because there were very few services to begin with. And this is a theme that came up very strongly, especially in places like Vancouver and Toronto, where they had a very clearly articulated system of homeless services in place already. And no one had asked for this intervention. I mean, it was an intervention that, I mean, most of Carol's balloons were kind of going from the ground up. This intervention came from the sky down to people. And they had to kind of figure out why is it visiting us and how do we make room for it. And there were practices in place, including the way people rented up apartments or the criteria for housing, that were already well established. And so now you're coming with this other intervention and saying, well, you know, here's what this looks like. You start with the client and you find locations ahead of time. Moncton was not at all problematic because they had so few services. They were grateful for the intervention. It was also of a scale that made a significant difference to them in terms of being able to handle a lot of the people that were homeless in their system already. It also, I mean, the challenging part was that it had not been implemented in any rural area, and so Moncton itself is not a very large city, and they were going to the greater Moncton area, so the usual issues of transportation and how to identify people were there. Interesting sort of side notes were, you know, in the initial implementation, for example, on the housing side, the site coordinator, who is the person that was referred to earlier, you know, she's a politician, a very charismatic, wonderful leader there of the community, was able to bring 25 of the city's landlords to a meeting. You know, in a single meeting, probably getting 60 or 70% of the landlords to hear about the project and have some buy-in.
And she fed them.
And what?
And she fed them.
And she fed them. You know, they started out shy. And what she had done was she brought an empty bowl to the table of this lunchtime meeting. And at the end of the meeting, after we had gone through what the job was, she asked them if they were interested to drop their cards in the bowl. It's very, it's sort of a nice touch to it. And everyone leaving the room, I say, with the exception of two or three people, dropped their business cards into the bowl, willing to do business with the project. So, you know, the difficult side in terms of what's happened following that tight network is that if you have a client that's a difficult client to house, every landlord knows about it. So there's that side of it, too, which is presents a whole other set of challenges. Going to Montreal was similarly, in a way, both, you know, in Jeff's presentation of qualitative data, he really captures all of the pluses and the minuses very well. And I would say that Montreal certainly had a long list of pluses, but also on the minus side. People were very excited about the project. There wasn't really much housing first work at all in Montreal, really, and yet there were, especially in some of the agencies, strong philosophical compatibility with the kind of the consumer-driven approach that we were advocating for, Diogen in particular. Others, not so much at all. But the landlord issue, it came up very strong quickly. Montreal had a very powerful social housing group, which is really what is set aside for poor people. It's a nonprofit form of providing housing for poor people. It's not like Section 8, but it's government subsidized heavily. And in order to qualify, there's an income test, but you also need to be a rather good tenant. You need to be a very grateful poor person who is well behaved in the housing in order to be able to sustain it. In some ways, it looks like the continuum of care we've set up here since the 80s. It's not quite a steppy, and it goes to permanent housing rather quickly, but it's congregate often and shared spaces, and the norms and requirements of the tenants are way above the standard lease. And so if you don't make it in that kind of social housing, there's nowhere for you to go. So the idea that you could rent free market units for people that are not making it in social housing and pay additional money to private landlords was considered sort of a capitalist American intervention that, you know, looking to, you know, bring capitalism into social housing. Which was kind of true, but, it was just, it was another way of doing business, and it was not really either philosophically or practically in place there at all. Is there anything else I should say about Montreal?
Well, just that some of that sentiment has definitely turned itself around in since they've seen how it works. So the initial resistance to the idea has moderated with actual experience seeing it work. So we're in a different position now than we were at the beginning.
I think that's true for everything that I'm going to say, because I'm really talking about sort of the memories of the implementation aspect and the challenges. I think it's true in most of the cities that now we're 1 year or more, two into the project, and data has been collected and people have been housed. I think there is a conversion experience as people see the utility of it. Toronto, also very strong housing network. They have a Streets to Homes program, which is very much like a Housing First program. People go right from the streets to apartments. Their follow-up services were very different. They used primarily a brokerage model. And for people that we would use ACT on, they would usually try and find congregate housing. So it was a modification. They didn't see a need for a new model. They took a little persuasion initially. One of the issues that was consistent even at the beginning was the concern about sustainability. Okay, this is a great project and we'll take it, but what are we going to do when the federal dollars run out? So those were some of the considerations. On the plus side, they were totally familiar with renting apartments, totally comfortable with harm reduction. Getting people from streets to homes was what they already did. So it was an easy fit in that way. Winnipeg, very poor social service network, very grateful for the project. Again, enormous impact. There's 500 people that are housed in this project from Winnipeg. We had some philosophical conversations that sort of changed the look of the intervention. You know, ACT is interdisciplinary. They did not want a Western interdisciplinary. They wanted an Aboriginal interdisciplinary. We included a tribal healer, other spiritual helpers that would sort of represent the medicine wheel approach to healing as part of the team. There were interesting and easy modifications to make to the model and still be pretty consistent with, you know, the 724 on call and all of that. But the staffing pattern was adjusted to fit that. They had a very strong housing finding service, but they were set in their ways and were comfortable housing people from all social needs with landlords they already had partnerships with, and it was hard to break the housing finders into new patterns of locating apartments that were more consistent with consumer choice. And that was true in the cities where there was a strong housing program already operational. And in Vancouver, of course, it was sort of the harm reduction capital of Canada, and that was not a controversial issue. There's lots of single-site housing first type buildings, like the downtown Seattle type projects. It's very all over the West Coast, actually. That's a very prevalent model. And they didn't think they really would get much in the way of buy-in in terms of people wanting to leave the downtown east side, because that's where their communities were. And it was seen as a little bit of meddling with people's lifestyle and bringing some sort of judgment to what they were doing, you know, imposing middle-class values. There was no shortage of philosophical discussion about the meaning of this thing. And yet they have done a spectacular job of being able to find scattered site housing outside of that downtown hub and implement the program quite well. And I think that's really the bottom line. In all of the discussions about these kinds of nuanced differences between how housing is found and how the clinical teams initially operated and where they are now in terms of their coordination, going back and using a fidelity scale, and the fidelity scale looks like a lot like the ACT scale and supported housing scale morphed together. But if you know them at all, those are mostly about structural issues. We included some of the questions that would capture the treatment philosophy in the one that we put together in terms of are the practices attentive to consumer choice, and are the practices consistent with a recovery orientation that teaches mastery rather than encourages dependency. And so they're quite the specific in their measurement. You know, how long does it take between intake to find an apartment and so on. And they do vary across the different sites depending on the structural elements that I described, how the housing authority works with the team, for example. And we don't know how it'll play out in the outcomes overall, but we're finding very strong fidelity to the model. People have really used the visits and the scoring to kind of improve their practice and move closer to the model. And it's going to be very interesting to see the extent to which the local variations are affecting outcomes once we're there. And that's it.
So you've been very patient with us, so now it's your turn. Please ask us questions or make comments, and if you have a individual that you want to ask answer the question, let us know, because people will need to come up here to answer. But surely, after all this, you've got some things to say. Yes?
In one of my prior jobs, I worked on several participatory action kind of paradigm projects, one of which dealt with consumer-operated services. And a lot of the issues that you raise as far as getting people to buy in and the philosophical differences, the differences with respect to instrumentation, I could have been back on that project 10 years ago, stateside. And I'm wondering if there's something, I'm wondering about the commonalities and differences in terms of sort of the Canadian approaches to service provision and the different attitudes about personal responsibility versus societal responsibility, how those might have played roles in getting the buy-in and getting the fidelity to implementation. Anybody who would like to take that on?
Okay, let me see if I can repeat the question. So the question is about community participatory research, and although there are a lot of commonalities between what we've said and the individual's experience in the States, she wonders if culture and attitudes about society and its role may have played a part in our project that's different in terms of the Canadian scene.
Well,
I would guess yes. I'm originally from the States. I'm from Kansas, but I've been in Canada for most of my career. And I think the issue around coming to the table and trying to find a common societal response to a public problem, I think it's easier in Canada than it would have been in the U.S., just because of the kind of shared healthcare system. We're accustomed to having a national response to healthcare problems that's provincially delivered. And some of the attitudes generally about safety nets and the willingness to pay more tax to provide a better safety net. Some of those things, I think, do help for a more civil society kind of response to things. But I would be glad to hear what other people thought.
I think I would echo that. I'm Canadian, but I work most of my life in the States. and going back to Canada, participating in this kind of a cross-site study has been a unique experience from my observation of participating in cross-site studies in the States, several different rounds. And I think that one of the dimensions, just organizationally, is the approach to hierarchy versus collaboration. I think that in many projects I participated in where the government has come with $110 million, actually that's not happened in this country. It's been much more modest for a much larger country. So just that level of commitment is one thing. But the level of collaboration, I thought, was actually extraordinary. The tolerance for and patience for the cities, for example, even in the structure of it, the cities had to collaborate to participate. There's only one proposal per city. That means all of the anguished competition about who's getting this had to be resolved locally. So by the time it approached the national level to be funded, there was already a resolution of many of the issues. There was sort of a stakeholders' levels of input from consumers to providers to researchers at every level, and then into the central group. There was a national work group that was all about the providers, the consumers, and the housing group, the clinical providers, that would troubleshoot problems both single site and cross site and share information. So there was an organizational structure that provided for input at every level, and a kind of a patience and a diligence about really making that. It wasn't just heard; it was actually action taken on it, and the collaboration. I would say those were the big cultural differences, and we didn't have the endless discussions about who's Medicaid eligible or not, and you know, all of that talk about how do you actually make this happen was, in terms of the financial eligibility piece, was a welcomed omission.
If you want to move to Canada. Yeah, next question.
A couple of things. First is an amazing project. Thank you so much for sharing. It's inspiring. If possible, in Ms. Adair's presentation, there was a quick slide on metrics that she skipped. If we could just take a quick
yeah. So let me read a question about men. Look at it while he's asking his question.
And then the final question is, what sorts of processes do you have in place now for ongoing development, continued collaboration, adjustment in process? Obviously, with the takeoff, you had some adjustments that you made during that period. What's kind of the setup now, and as you run into additional ethical issues, how's that going to be?
Okay. So we'll come back to a second question about what we're doing now to continue the process of adjustment and consultation. But first, let's hear about the question about methods.
Just tell me, stop.
It was
the matrix.
Oh, the.
I think. Did you? This one?
Just directly after that. Just for a moment, I'm sorry.
Oh.
Four.
This one?
That's okay. This is a great site. It identifies it pretty clearly. I guess what I was looking for was the specific metrics in some of these.
Okay.
Yeah,
that's coming.
It's a blue one.
Okay, and when they were done.
There's one that has a list of actual instruments.
Yeah, this one, okay.
Repeat the question.
I didn't hear the question yet.
No,
go ahead.
This was the question. I just wanted to see that slide. I look forward to seeing it online and available.
We have a toolkit for all of these. It's funny where they came from, their references, everything. Mm-hmm.
So tell them how to find it, the protocol kit?
Actually, you should probably just email me, because we're updating it to get the most recent one. My email address is on the last slide, and the slides are available in your, however you get them through APHA.
So the process now, it continues to be one of a lot of conversation and discussion with the various stakeholders. So we have regular teleconferences and in-person meetings with the national research team. We also have regular meetings and with our national working group. We have a consumer panel that meets on a regular basis, both telephone and in person. So in those meetings and in those discussions, what we are dealing with are problems that arise and their solution, in which we're trying to take a combined approach. We also have a safety and adverse events group that meets regularly and reviews all of the adverse events that have been reported in all the sites. And Diego actually has been the first author on an article describing how we had to revise our thinking even about ethics. We couldn't find anything that would help us set up an appropriate review process and definition of what we meant by a critical incident, so we developed one, and he's written about it. The journal is?
IRB, Ethics in Human Research.
And Diego Silva, S-I-L-V-A, is the first author.
So it came out July, August, or one of the summer months issue.
Yeah.
And it's through the Hastings Center in New York that publishes it.
So that's been a very learning experience in and of itself, and we have found that it's a forum in which we can and generate cross-site learning. So one of the things we noticed a pattern early on was that there were a fair number of fires because we had people with kitchens that had never had kitchens or didn't know for a long time hadn't had kitchens. And our Winnipeg crew quickly installed a special kind of device that turns the oven or the stove off if there's no motion in the room for a particular point of time. And as soon as we learned about that, we let all the other sites know. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so that's just an example of where the kind of process of sharing information about events helps us identify potential solutions. That group has also been compiling regular information about the deaths that we've encountered. And I don't, in the last report, how many had we had, Diego?
It was north of 30.
Oh, almost 40, 40, 40.
35, I remember.
Yeah. Anyway, we anticipated that. It's still very painful to have it happen for the teams and for, across the board, but it has been very important for us and for our research ethics boards for us to be tracking that and reporting it and knowing what we had to expect in that realm. So any other questions or comments? We're almost finished. Yeah. Okay, so the question is about the consumer panel, and it is a group nationally that is led by Gigi Veronica, who has been our consumer research lead from the beginning of the project. I recruited her for the very first planning meeting, and she's been with us since. She's been a remarkable leader who's actually helped us design and implement consumer groups in each of the sites. And the national panel has reps from each of the sites. They include people that were recruited to actually be peer support workers on the teams, as well as we have some research assistants who are consumers, and then we have people representing those who have been homeless and mentally ill. It's been an extremely active and helpful panel to us, not only responding to requests from us for assistance with the protocol and giving us feedback, but also generating their own issues. And they've developed a couple of papers that are quite interesting. One of them was to help us prepare participants in our program for media interactions, to think really carefully about making sure people were understanding what could happen if they were broadcast or on TV or on the radio or in a newspaper. Another one has been a document around how stigma and discrimination is being experienced and what can be done in the program in general about that. So a very important part of the project, they've improved our quality and our responsiveness in lots of ways. We'll also be writing specifically about that so that we'll be able to share that. So we have to close now. Thank you very much for coming, and we appreciated it. And we are glad that you were interested enough to stay till the end. Bye-bye.